Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
University chaplain Scott Evans wrote recently in his college newspaper about how to recognise and handle anxieties. And he had a story for me that I wasn't expecting about something that happened to Scott that sent his anxiety levels through the roof.
Back in 2014, I think it was, I received a phone call from from my guard down in Kilkenny Garden Station, and was informed. I answered the phone actually and said, "Hey, you know," and they said, "Is this Scott Evans?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely. And what can I help you with?" And I think he immediately knew that I had no idea what he was about to tell me. But what he told me was that I had tried in absentia and found guilty for three road traffic offences, contempt of court for not attending the trial, been fined €1,400 and sentenced to 7 days in Port Leash prison. It was a pretty scary phone call.
And so, presuming you knew nothing about it, what had happened?
So, somebody had given us a car a couple of years before that, and I was running an internship program as part of our diocesan youth ministry down in Kilkenny, and so they had given the car to me, and then I had given it to. It had only been transferred into my name just in order for them to get it off their books, and then I transferred it into the ownership of the person who ran our staff team, and then she transferred it over to a former intern's name who was continuing to work in the area, and at some point she accrued three fines, but she had no idea about them because they were sent to me, but they weren't sent to me at an address I lived at anymore. They were sent to the address I used to live at, and then that's when I didn't pay the fines, they sent reminders, which obviously I also didn't get. Then they sent somebody with a summons, and apparently one of my neighbours told them that I still lived in the place, even though I didn't. And so then I was tried in absentia, and it all happened a year before. So all these trials were going on as I was leaving.
And you had no clue. So tell me about what that did to your anxiety levels.
Yeah, well, it was two things. One was the anxiety about the future. And the anxiety about the future was, you know, what's going to happen? Like, I know that I'm not guilty of this. I know that I didn't live in the place that they sent the fines to. I know that I didn't commit any road traffic offences. I know that I didn't do any of those things. But injustices happen, you know? Like,
what did you say to the guard on the phone?
I actually said, is there any chance that you could check your record? Like, if you have access to who owns what car, like to car records to the Department of Transport, can you check and see if I owned the car at the time these fines came in? And he went away and checked and came back and he said, it's really weird. It's not even just that you weren't the last owner.
Yeah.
It's been two owners since you owned this car.
And he was the first person to check that, obviously, because they hadn't checked it in the court. So he was at that point reasonably sympathetic to you, was he?
Yeah, no, he was, absolutely. But he just said, well, the problem is the trial's already happened. If it had just been the tickets themselves, then it wouldn't be a problem. But he can't overrule Kilkenny District Court on the basis of evidence he sees on a computer screen.
So how did you sort it? How did you sort it out?
I went down with a letter from my landlord.
Yeah.
Said I didn't live in the place where they sent the fines to, and a letter from my... it was actually a letter from the landlord who owned the place I used to live at, that the things were sent to, and a letter from the Department of Transport saying I didn't own the car. But what was mad is that, like, I was so anxious about the trial in and of itself, but the other thing it made me really anxious of is, if this can be happening, like, what can be happening behind my back that I don't know about at any time?
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
It impacts your trust, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, and this trust that you've done the right thing and that everything's fine, it makes you kind of think that there's, like, kind of monsters lurking around every corner that are going to kind of jump out and get you.
Yeah.
And that's a tough thing to carry around. And I think that's how a lot of people feel about this crisis.
The best of the morning show.
DCU history professor Juliana Edelman admits that she has come late to the party when it comes to being an admirer of Ernest Shackleton, the Irish-born polar explorer. But when she got the idea of a podcast series, What Would Shackleton Do in the Coronavirus Crisis, Juliana knew she would have no problem finding knowledgeable people to talk about him.
These people, all the people that I speak to on the podcast, are absolute experts. They've read loads about Shackleton. They're really engaged in their own kinds of research, but also in just, very knowledgeable about Shackleton's own works and his life. So it's great because they bring that enthusiasm, which is much more, you know, I think historians can be really engaging and enthusiastic. But when you get somebody who is just doing this for the love of it, they have a great way of engaging other people who are not experts. So I think that's what they've all brought to the table. And it's much better than if I had just read a script about what we might learn from Shackleton. So it's been a really interesting and exciting process.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I want to talk to you about some of the other things later on, but it is one of the sad things, isn't it, about academic writing and academic life, that sometimes the very enthusiasm that brought you into it in the first place kind of gets beaten out of you over
yeah,
time.
I know, I mean,
it shouldn't.
And I think there's a style of academic writing and presentation that, you know, that just is for an academic audience,
yes,
and sometimes
yeah, sure.
we forget that other people might be interested if we could speak differently. So it's been really inspiring from that point of view, because they all speak very well and really engagingly about Shackleton.
Brilliant. So, turning to the strangeness that we find ourselves in at the moment, what are some of the challenges Shackleton's experienced that we can kind of relate to during lockdown today, do you think?
Yeah, so we started off just thinking about how his experience of being, you know, on a kind of isolated expedition and working in a small team and things might relate. And then it was actually Jonathan who pointed out that actually Shackleton had written an article in I think it's the Boy's Own magazine, about the four qualities that every person needed for life, as he saw it. And those were optimism, patience, courage, and idealism. And then it seemed actually quite natural to structure the series around that. And we've added to that on Kevin's inspiration, kindness. So the final podcast will be with a nurse who's working in the health system at the moment. So I think all those qualities are things that we're being asked to delve deep for at the moment, and are clearly things that shaped Shackleton's approach to each of his expeditions. So we started off with optimism, and that's just so important to all of us, to maintaining mental health, you know, thinking that there's a positive endpoint in the future and trying to keep ourselves focused on that goal and being optimistic and keeping our spirits up and trying to make those around us feel better and stay optimistic. And Shackleton was absolutely amazing at that particular quality. And it's amazing when you think of how optimistic that they would get home. They remained after the endurance expedition goes terribly, horribly wrong. And then patience is the other one that we've completed, that's up on the podcast platforms. And certainly, I mean, I think all of us are feeling our patience is fraying maybe a little bit at this point, with, you know, just the restrictions and the lack of social interaction. And, you know, and I think that the ways of maintaining your patience that Shackleton and all of his men, Frank Wilde, was particularly highlighted as well by Seamus, in terms of, you know, having a routine, having small things to look forward to, keeping yourself busy and occupied. So there's lots of kind of little tidbits like that. And I think, and also, it's a really interesting story, so you get those tidbits in the context of a great narrative.
It really strikes me, listening to you, Juliana, the idea that really we're talking about kind of character, aren't we? You know, we're not talking about just things he did, but there was something from inside of him. Now, I understand he was probably as fallible and weak a person as any of us, but did you find, you know, as you kind of explored him, that you kind of were impressed by him as a person?
Well, you'd be hard pressed not to be impressed. Yes, he's a very impressive person. Although it's funny, he's not infallible, and
sure.
he's and his kind of capacity for a certain kind of quality in an urgent and emergency and difficult situation is maybe not matched with his capacity in the rest of his life. So you know, he's a terribly unsuccessful businessman. He, you know, runs through a lot of money. I think his wife had a very hard time of it.
Mm.
So he's great in the urgent situation where people's lives depend on him, and then a little bit less great in the rest of in the rest of his
doing. Way, like, isn't it? Yeah, it's really funny. I remember seeing somebody saying something similar about Churchill. You know, he was the only person that they could have used during the Second World War, but like outside of that, he wasn't so great. You know what though? It's a wonderful thing to kind of get a kind of, I suppose, get under the bonnet of a story that we kind of think we know, particularly Irish people, because we've kind of read it in so many ways, and we have the Tom Crean version, and we have the various other versions that we've read through the time. We've seen a lot of, you know, maybe thing, you know, documentaries on the TV, and people have read books. It's really, really a fascinating angle that you've chosen, and I think it, you know, well done for doing it. When you say that, that kind of initial spark of inspiration, when it came, did you go, yeah, this is going to work?
Yeah, I had this title rumbling through my head. What would Shackleton do? This sort of, and I thought it would be interesting way of attracting people maybe who weren't familiar with the Shackleton story, to get familiar, and also, as you say, it would be a different angle on what we know. And it's certainly a heroic tale, and it's often told in that way, but it's also a tale of all these kind of quieter, more difficult qualities that maybe we don't think about when we kind of are amazed by the fact that he manages to, you know, rescue all of these men and go on this incredible voyage across open seas in a tiny little open boat. So, you know, and it seems like something none of us could ever do, but actually it's all based around, you know, what he saw as very basic qualities that everyone needs.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Padraig Quinlan is an engineer with a passion for teaching. It became a significant thread in his engineering career, where he found himself giving a lot of training courses. And then 8 years ago, he switched full-time to teaching mathematics and English to school students using the Kumon method. Here Padraig explains what Kumon means.
There was a maths teacher called Mr. Kumon. People are disappointed in that. They think Kumon has a meaning in the Japanese language. Mr. Kumon, back over 50 years ago. And his own child was having difficulty with maths, and he put some thought into the best way to bring his child back up to where he was, and it just evolved over the 50 years and has gone global. And one of the things that's at the heart, Ronan, that would surprise a lot of people, I don't teach the kids in the conventional sense.
Okay, tell us.
If a child comes to us with a question that they don't understand, we don't just tell them the answer. We try to reframe it. We ask them how they did the previous question and the one before that, because they don't get, you know, dramatically harder. They're incremental. So we bring them back to the previous question, or we ask them a question that we know they know the answer to, because we know all the kids very well. And then we ask them to relate to that. And sometimes we'll give them 10 or 15 second silence for the cogs to turn in their head until they figure around and have that light bulb moment where they say, oh, I get it, it's 17.
Brilliant.
And then they go back to their desk, delighted with themselves, because if they figure out the answer, they're more likely to remember it and get value out of it. Another example would be how we introduce division. So we would introduce division in maths after a child has been doing and mastering multiplication. And when they're doing a new topic, that would always be in class. So they come to class and they open this page and it says 6 multiplied by something equals 18. And if they know their tables well enough, they just, they know it's 3. And then 7 multiplied by something is 35. And they say, well, I know 7 fives is 35, so they put in the 5. And without knowing it, they're dividing.
Yeah.
They're doing division backwards.
Very good.
And they turn over the next page, and it says 7 multiplied by 3 is 21. 21 divided by 7 is 3.
And you're making all those connections. It's brilliant. You know, I'll talk to you in a minute about how that applies to something like English as opposed to just maths. But I'm picturing you there in Dundrum, and I'm going, who comes for this? Who has a requirement, or who recognizes the need in themselves or in their child, and goes, do you know what they need? They need the Kumon method.
Very good question, Onan. We would have children, I suppose 3/4, to pick a number, would be students who are having difficulty. A parent has had a parent-teacher meeting, or the parent is engaged with their child's homework, they're observing it, and they see mistakes, they see difficulties, they see they're not getting a concept, whether that's in maths or English. They don't know what a verb is in English. They don't understand the difference between tenses in English, or whatever it might be. And then they go Googling.
Yeah.
Are they, a lot of the time, they'll hear it word of mouth. Word of mouth is probably one of our strongest marketing.
So you're seeing people outside. You it's not like you have a kind of a regular school that people go to 9 to 3 or 9 to 4.
Okay. I didn't really explain that. I have a class in normal times. I'm still in COVID mode.
Okay.
I have a class in normal times on a Wednesday and a Saturday.
Okay.
So the students come once a week. They do their collect their homework. They take their new homework for the following week. My staff record how they've been doing that week, how long it's been taking them, how many errors they're making. We observe them in class. So every week I gather this information from every child, and every week I reset their homework. If I see that they're doing it comfortably, time-wise, without too many errors, I'll move them on. If I see they're taking a bit longer than I'd like them to, or they're making a few more errors than I'd like them to, or any other reason, I'll repeat that work.
Right. And are these children who are already in school somewhere else, or are they coming to you exclusively for school?
No, supplementary, 100%.
Right. Absolutely supplementary. Yeah. So it's really, really fascinating to me that, you know, so in a way you don't have to kind of create a curriculum, as it were.
Correct.
You kind of hook yourself into whatever is going on in already. Yeah, in the child's life. It's really, really fascinating. What is it like for you as a teacher right now to be teaching remotely, particularly this kind of stuff?
It's lonely. Every teacher relishes the interaction with kids.
Yeah,
the eye contact and the interaction and the little chats, because it's not a sweatshop. No. It's not kids coming along and coming out crying and sweating and red faces. They come along, they do the work. It's very routine.
Yeah.
Most kids are engaged and excited by doing new work. They're doing roughly 15-20 minutes worth of work every day. They do homework 7 days a week. They do it throughout the year. So it just becomes part of their life.
Yeah.
We always give a comfortable starting point because we want to build up their confidence, and we want them to be able to make Kumon part of their 7 day routine.
Yeah, just listening to you, Porik, you know, I'm imagining that idea of you, you know, like keying into an individual child,
yes,
getting the sense of where they're at, getting into their process, helping them, listening to the cogs turning and giving them some space. And then if they come up with the thing that is the answer, there must be a tremendous feeling of reward in that for you.
Hugely, Ronan. We work with super bright kids who can do maths just comes to them, or English just comes to them, you know, they just see no difficulty. And that's great to see. I have kids who are in primary school and they're doing differentiation that I did in engineering in UCD.
Wow.
And that's great to see.
Yeah.
But I also have kids who, when I assess them, their confidence is on the floor. They have no self-belief at all. And then 3 or 4 months later, they come in with their chest out and they say, I came fifth in my Friday test.
Wow.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Emmett Harton runs a business delivering nutritious cooked meals to people's doors. The business is called Kayla's Kitchen, and it grew from his efforts to help his little daughter, Kayla, who had a serious medical condition, by providing her with healthy and interesting food. Here Emmett talks about his daughter.
Well, Kayla is 12 now, but when she was around two and a half, she was diagnosed with a condition known as Rett syndrome, which is a non-hereditary genetic mutation that causes havoc with a child's development. We didn't really notice it at the very, very start when she was a baby, but we started to notice problems as she hit about one and she wasn't walking and she wasn't learning to talk, and she was losing skills, any skills that she had acquired.
My goodness, yeah. You were her full-time carer at the time, and
yes.
at that stage, are you beginning to panic, or what's the story?
It's a kind of a growing concern, because, you know, I was looking after her day in, day out, and, you know, I've a huge effort to try and get her to learn how to use a simple block toy or how to just climb a step or two, and then, you know, within weeks, you notice that she's lost that skill, and that really starts setting alarm bells off. And we started visiting the different doctors and trying to find out why she was constantly chewing her fingers, and she would never take her fingers out of her mouth. And, you know, she was two before she learned to walk at all.
Right.
So, yeah, I describe it as a growing sense of unease, and, you know, like a constant effort to try and not think the worst.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then it becomes the worst.
You're kind of looking. You're looking down the line at other kids and going, maybe she's still a little slow here or there, and maybe she'll catch up, and all these kinds of things.
Yeah, you're looking. You know, you're looking. You're saying, oh, it's only dyspraxia. It's not something else. Like a brother actually cottoned on or latched on to Rett syndrome before the doctors did.
Seriously.
And we thought, no, well, it's not autism. It's not. It's only dyspraxia.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, you end up getting the worst, and you know,
and devastating. What point, Emma, did you feel like the penny kind of dropped with you?
Oh, we weren't listening to any pennies dropping.
Really? Yeah.
No, it was the diagnosis. The in Temple Street, the doctor just hit us with it, and it knocked us for six.
Gosh.
We really weren't entertaining any prospect of it being as serious a diagnosis as it was.
And what age was she at that point?
By that point, she was, I think, 2.5, coming right. upon. She was 2 years old, yes. February of 2010.
So like an absolute nuclear explosion going off for you, I suppose.
It laid waste. I mean, there's nothing. You just, the world is grey. There's nothing going through your head, really, except some kind of sense of doom.
So out of that, did the Kayla's Kitchen thing begin to form in your mind?
It did. I had been making all her food from the time she'd gone on to solids. I'd been making everything, and when she got the diagnosis, I got straight to work reading all about what we could do to give her the best chance in every sense, in terms of education, but also what I was finding was that nutrition was extremely important in giving her the best chance in the long run in terms of growth, in terms of general health, in terms of digestion, in terms of being able to walk and have the energy and promoting her brain development and all of that. So I started focusing on the best balanced nutrition across the day. And then what I noticed very quickly was that because of her condition, she's deprived of the use of her hands, she can't speak, she has very poor attention, she has learning difficulties, and I noticed that she took particular joy and satisfaction in her food.
Wow.
As one of her senses.
Brilliant.
So I tried to focus also on bringing out the most robust kind of flavors, like really diverse flavors, so that each dish was really different to the last one, and that it would be a little moment of sensory stimulation, of
Brilliant.
Enjoyment, and something she could relish every time she sat down to a meal, that it'd be something that would look good, taste good. And she also had some aversions to particular textures, so we tried to make sure that she wasn't presented with those, so that it was always a positive experience to eat.
I'm just thinking about this as a kind of almost a creative journey for yourself too. Did you have any background in health or nutrition or cooking or any of that stuff yourself?
Not so much in health and nutrition. I'd have had a running interest in science, and you know, I would have been the type of person who would have read The New Scientist every week and all of that.
Come on.
But I would have been looking for, or naturally looking for, a creative outlet. I'd always worked in creative businesses, in graphics or in animation and things in previous lives.
Yeah.
So it, you know, cooking came naturally to me as another creative process.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And more like I would always been more. You know, I would have liked, when I was much younger, to think of myself as a budding artist, but really, craft is...
Yeah.
Craft is what I gravitate towards, rather than... I wouldn't call myself anything like an artist anymore.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Most parents around the country are having to take a more hands-on approach to their children's schooling at the moment, and it can raise an interesting dilemma. Am I to act now like a teacher or a parent? Katrina Lynch talked to me about the things that can run through a parent's head when they find out that their child is struggling with a school subject.
Internally, my internal talk can be, jeepers, I knew you weren't great at the maths, but I didn't realize you were so rubbish.
I know. It's, and that feels, and it's actually, now I'm the problem because I'm actually panicking.
And it's clearly my fault. Yes. First of all, you feel guilty, and you know, that I never tweaked this before.
Yes.
How could you have been so bad? And I never knew.
You've been 14 years in school and I only figured this out now.
No, you know, and I should have been on top of this, and I should have been, you know. So then the response to the guilt is, I'm going to make it better. I'm going to fix it.
And in you go like a train.
Exactly. And then, of course, you know, if you're competitive, your competitiveness takes over.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, by the time you go back to school in September, you are going to be top of the class.
That's right. You're going to be a genius.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, you have suddenly, you've got all this on top. You have taken on board this commitment and this responsibility on top of trying to cope with your job in really weird circumstances and all the other things that we're trying to cope with. And is it any wonder that we're kind of falling apart at the seams and forgetting to sort of look at yourself in the mirror, if you can bear to?
Because
we've all gone a bit deceived, I think. and say, hang on a minute. As I could have said, hang on a minute, Katrina, you're their mother.
Yeah.
You know, you have the grace and the ability to be their mother. And part of the job of, the enormous part of the job is to be there to love, to comfort, to encourage. And we can forget about that. And unfortunately then, we bring the classroom into the kitchen.
Yeah, that's right.
And when normally we would have been sitting there chatting, how did the day go and all that sort of stuff, we're looking at them at the table going, so you're the fellow now who just can't do the maths, and you're your woman who won't do her piano practice, and me spending all this money on your piano lessons and your rubbish because you're lazy.
Yeah.
And we're judging them out of all this stuff that heretofore we would have known nothing about.
Yeah, that's, you know what, you make that's such a good point. Encountering our own children's avoidance can be very destructive for us, particularly if we were a little bit avoidant ourselves, because it really stirs up a tremendous amount of, you know, I suppose what Carl Jung would have called the shadow, the feeling, actually, I'm seeing myself in you and I'm afraid for you.
Exactly. And realising from a mature adult point of view, you know, I could have been so much better. I could have gone to college and done this, that and the other if I'd only just done me study.
I know.
I'm not going to let you make those
same mistakes. I know.
I'm going to get you to do that study. And then, and why do we do it? Not because we want our children to have a really good choice and be able to do all the things that they would love to do.
Yeah, look, you're right. It's motivated by my love. I mean, you know, we want the best for them, but in a way there's that feeling of like, we don't want them to make the same mistakes we did, but in some ways they kind of nearly have to.
In order to become the people that God has in store for them, we have to learn from our experiences and our mistakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the concern, you know, here is that we will become so overwhelmed and engulfed in trying to be a really good teacher, a really good motivating piano teacher, a really good coach, that we will lose sight of being a parent.
And
that is what they need more than anything else.
You
know what, I was talking to a couple of friends of mine who are teachers, and they were saying everybody is going to be behind in September.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone. And they are already taking that into account.
They've built that in. You're absolutely right. And here, you know, this is the thought that I wanted to just ask you about. The idea that actually we don't realise we've been built with resilience. The Lord made us with resilience. And if we have faith that, you know, that bounce back ability kind of thing, that, you know, we have it, but our children have it as well.
Absolutely. And in bucket loads. Because they're young and, you know, they don't have to worry about mortgages and they don't have to worry about bills and they don't have to worry about unemployment and all those kind of things. So when they get back into their natural environment, the wheels will kick in and they will start to catch up.
The Best of the Morning Show.
There's a great opportunity over the next few days to watch the play God Has No Country, as it will be available on the website of the Town Hall Theatre in Westport for free until Wednesday. It's written and performed by Donald Courtney, and it's about a fellow Kerryman, the extraordinary Father Hugh O'Flaherty, the Scarlet Pimpernel of the Vatican. Here's Donald Courtney.
Well, essentially the play is about, as you said, Hugh O'Flaherty, who was a Monsignor in Rome during World War II, a Kerryman, and he became known as the Pimpernel of the Vatican because he saved the lives, him and his companions saved the lives of 6,500 people from the fascist, you know, the Nazi regime there. And it was all sorts. He saved Jewish people, civilians, military people from all nationalities. And so the play tells his story and the story of that 18-month period in his life where he evaded capture. It's told in a humorous way, believe it or not, even though it's a very serious story. But the Monsignor was a very charismatic, funny kind of a character who used to dress up and evade capture. This is where he got the nickname from. So he never told his story. He took the story to the grave. And I felt, even though the story was known and was getting more known, I felt it would be appropriate to tell the story from his voice, from his point of view, how he would have remembered those events, you know. So that's kind of where it all came from. And I'm from Killarney and have a personal connection to his family, and I just felt it was right for me to do it, you know.
I love that sculpture that they put up in recent years in Killarney of Monsignor O'Flaherty. It's really, it actually, you almost feel like, gosh, I'd love to have met that fella. I bet he was great crack.
he really was a character, and they made the statue larger than life, you know.
Sure.
And you know, it's the most engaged statue within Killarney. People love it. And,
yeah, that's brilliant, yeah.
I was looking up to get a photograph taken next to it in costume, doing the exact same pose, you know, which is a lovely thing to have as well, you know.
Yeah, that's such a good thing. So did you actually, you enjoyed playing him by the sounds of things?
Oh, I loved playing him. I loved writing it. I loved researching it. But bringing it to life and being on stage and bringing the story to people who were not familiar with it, whether it's here in Ireland or abroad, has been the most joyous part of all of this, you know, introducing him to people for the first time and just being on stage for an hour as him, you know, and walking in those footsteps. It's very enjoyable. I know that sounds strange because it's such a serious story, but he was such a charismatic, flamboyant man, you know. He's a joy to play.
Now, as you said, quite rightly said, it's also very serious, and there's deadly serious background to this particular story. One of the most striking scenes in the play is Monsignor O'Flaherty's recounting of a massacre in Rome. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Yeah, well, it was actually towards the end of the occupation, and they actually thought that the Allies were approaching and were going to liberate Rome. But the anti-fascists who were fighting the Gestapo and the Germans carried out some car bomb attacks. And actually, when I went to Rome to do the play, the hotel I stayed in was on the same street where this actual attack took place. I could see the bullet holes on the wall, you know.
Gosh. Wow.
Yeah, amazing. And so the German revenge for that, if you like, was they decided that there was 33 German police killed. So they decided to take revenge by killing 10 times that many people. So they took 330 random men from all walks of life in Rome. Some were connected to the fascists, many weren't. Some would have known stuff, some would not, you know, so completely innocent of any involvement in any activities. They brought clergy, they brought people from all occupations and classes, and they executed them all one by one in their time caves. They actually executed 335 because they miscounted the numbers. They added in five more people. And it's the most horrific massacre in Italy during World War II.
And you've been to the cave, I believe, where
it
happened.
I've been to the cave, yeah. I've been there. It's quite moving. And I tell that story in more detail in the play and how the Monsignor couldn't walk even after the war. It was the one part of Rome. He used to love walking around Rome, but he could never go near those caves where that massacre, some of his friends were killed there, you know. And I think that was, I mean, he always thought it was senseless, everything, but that really encapsulated how senseless kind of war is and how random and, you know, these acts of madness are, you know. It was something that didn't have to happen. Because not long after, Rome was liberated, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Shocking.
Shocking stuff,
so,
yeah.
So would it be a stretch, given that, you know, the occupation in Rome was particularly because the Vatican was, you know, its own little principality in the middle of all that. Would it be a stretch to say that Monsignor O'Flaherty experienced a kind of lockdown but found ways to keep busy?
Absolutely. I think that's a brilliant way of putting this. That's exactly what happened. I mean, the Vatican was a neutral state. They did do a deal with the Germans once the Germans occupied Rome and Italy. And so it was this little oasis in the middle of Europe, really. You know what I mean? That was neutral. And so this is where he was able to bring people into the Vatican to protect them.
Yeah.
The problem was, though, the Vatican couldn't be seen to be involved. So you had to do this, even though the Pope and senior Vatican officials would have known the Monsignor was helping people, they wouldn't have been able to endorse it or be seen to be involved, you know. So he was hiding people from everybody. And it was a lockdown. It was an 18 months where people were in safe houses all over Rome as well. He had them outside the Vatican as well, and some in the countryside in Italy. But you're exactly right. It was exactly that, where people went into hibernation, if you like, and were hidden. Mm. And everything came to a standstill. And one of the few people who kind of braved it and took risks was Monsignor O'Flaherty.
The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.